talked about the antithesis. Scripture says in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then Carl Sagan said, the cosmos is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be. Which one of those is true? Right. Well, there's an antithesis, an opposite or a contrast. One of them is built upon a world and life view of Weltanschauung, remember? A comprehensive conception of the world from a specific viewpoint is built upon special revelation. God has revealed himself in Scripture, what he did and how he did it and when he's done it and all that. And that's how we know. That's our epistemology. How do you know that you know that you know? It's by faith that the Scriptures are the Word of God and a revelation of his mind, of his thinking. Now, if you're Carl Sagan, you reject that. Your epistemology is naturalism. It basically says that the universe is self-operating, self-directing, and self-explanatory. So if you want to know how the world got here and the universe, well, look at it. And if you investigate it long enough, it'll tell you. Maybe. Now, you read them, you find that they always end up by basically almost saying, maybe. Because you never can be sure when you found the ultimate reality under that principle. But anyway, that's how you know. And it's not only self-explanatory. The universe directs itself. There is no providence. God's not involved in history at all. History is just an unfolding of events that occur naturally as a result of natural law. So there's a difference. And that difference came, of course, to dominate. Obviously, after the 1860s, it got worse and worse in terms of a naturalistic world and life view until by the time you got to the 20th century. The institutions, particularly those north of the Ohio River and west of the Pecos, came to be dominated by a naturalistic world and life view. Now, that wasn't necessarily true if you'd gone to most southern universities at the time. That didn't come till later. And I think that's because there was a great revival. You remember the Confederate Army, 1862 to 64, the last, I think, really revival we've had in this country, which was a tremendous outpouring of the Spirit of God. And the Confederate Army all the way from Virginia into Texas, Arkansas, and what have you, right over here around Louisville, they had a great revival about 64, I believe it was over there, among the Confederate troops stationed there. And 150,000 men or so were converted, and those conversions appeared to have been genuine because it lasted after the war was over, and it dominated institutions. B.H. Carroll, you know, one of the men who helped found Baylor and Southwestern Seminary, was on his way home from the war, and he stopped off in Mississippi going through, and he stumbled into a church meeting. He stumbled in, he thought. Now, he later said, I didn't stumble in, because he said, now, you know, when I read Acts 13:48, he's talking about me. But anyway, he stumbled in there, and God converted him, saved him. He goes back to Texas, and he got back down there, and his wife had remarried. She said, I thought you were dead. We got word you'd been killed in the war 2 years ago. He said, well, I understand. I forget it. You know, you're married now, and that's over. So he went ahead and began working at Baylor, and then, of course, helped establish Southwestern Seminary. So the South experienced that great revival, and that revival lasted for a long, long time after the war was over. But by the time you get to the 1920s, it's beginning to affect the institutions in the South, and I think by the time you get to World War I or World War II, naturalism has come to be pretty well the dominant world and life view in most of the country. And when you do that, then of course think you're headed for the abyss. And I want you to read a statement here by Basil Manley Jr. that he made in the late 19th century. From the doubt of denial of God's book, the road is short to doubt or denial of God. And after that comes the abyss, where all knowledge is not only lost, but scoffed at, except that which the brute might enjoy as well. I think that is an excellent statement, and I think he's exactly right. Once you leave the Scriptures as the authority, then you're headed for the abyss. Okay, well, now, out of that movement came a movement called progressivism. You hear about it. You've heard Hillary Clinton said that if she's elected, she's going to try to realize the progressive goals. They've been trying to realize those goals since the early 20th century. Let me tell you something. They're not going to realize them because it's a major flaw in this whole absurd system. But we'll look at that a little bit later. Okay, progressives. Now, this came out of the early 20th century. Progressivism, as a political force, came into American life around the turn of the 20th century. Historians often refer to the period from 1901 to 1920 as the Progressive Era. That's a common expression if you take American history courses. This does not mean that the movement began or ended in that time period, but rather that its influence was first felt during that era. It has been a dominant force in American politics, culture, institutions, and life since that period. What then is progressivism? And the first of the progressive so-called presidents was Theodore Roosevelt, and then he was followed by William Howard Taft, who wasn't a progressive. It's an interesting story there. And then he was followed by Woodrow Wilson, who was a progressive. There's a story about Wilson, but anyway, we won't get involved in that here this morning. Wilson was a Southerner, raised in Virginia and what have you, Georgia. His father was in the Confederate Army, was a chaplain, was a Presbyterian, raised in Orthodox Presbyterian, you know, Calvinism. And Wilson was all right till he went off to John Hopkins in Baltimore. And he swallowed all that nonsense they taught him at John Hopkins. And he wound up at Princeton as a dean and then finally president and then governor of New Jersey, and then they elected him president in 1912. And he was a full-fledged progressive. Okay, then, what is a progressive? What is progressivism? Well, there's a good definition, I think. Progressivism is a movement that advocates the principle of indefinite progress and change toward a perfectible order. Man and his institutions are going to get better and better until crime, war, evil, poverty, etc. are eliminated, and man is perfect. Now, that's not a made-up definition. That's their own definition. And it goes back into the 19th century. You remember, we'll talk about it a little bit later, Horace Mann and others who begin advocating that principle. So that's what the progressive goals are. They're going to create a perfect world. You remember Woodrow Wilson? We're going to World War I. This is going to be the war that ends all wars. Because we got it figured out. And when this war is over, we're going to establish the League of Nations, and we'll all get together, and we'll sit down, and because men are rational, through reason and experience, we're going to work out our difficulties, and war will be abolished. Wars don't make any sense. Wars are unreasonable, said Wilson. I agree. It's an absurd action. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to figure out how to put an end to it as they thought they could. Well, anyway, that's what they were doing, that war. Now, the progressive said, in order to realize these progressive goals of ending all man's basic problems, there are three instruments. And if we use these instruments properly, we'll guarantee progress. It will inevitably follow. And those three instruments are science, through the scientific method. We can study man's basic problems physically and morally and what have you. And through that study, we'll be able to ultimately, through rational process and experience, work out the difficulties. And we'll eliminate all diseases through the scientific process. Then there'll be social and political planning. And we're going to look at that in a little bit more detail here in a minute. That's absolutely essential in order to realize the progressive goals. You have to plan what you're going to do. And who's going to plan it? Well, that's the intellectuals. The central planners, which are intellectuals. They're going to make the plans for you, and they'll work them out. And then through public education or the public school system. Absolutely necessary. That view was espoused by Horace Mann back in the 1830s. You know, when he made the comment that if we'd ever get the public school system He called it the normal school. He didn't say public at that time. You know, the normal school was established, set up, and all the children in them, and he was going to do that through the state compulsory attendance laws. The state would come out and tell you, you have to send your children to school. And if we do that, he said, we ought to realize by the 20th century, a crime would be a thing of the past. We'll sleep in our houses with unlocked doors and walk our streets in complete safety at night, he said, because crime will have disappeared. Criminal activity doesn't make any sense if you're rational. Does it? I agree, he's right. It doesn't make any sense. It's an absurd action. But now, getting rid of through the public school system, he just, no. And of course, what he said in abdicating, of course, was that the public school system, as it taught, it had to eliminate basically any biblical frame of references. And because he understood there's one principle in the Bible that it throws a kink in this whole progressive order. And it is a massive kink. It's called original sin. There's no such thing as that, as much said. Well, so anyway, get rid of that. Now, what happened when the public education system got started in this country in the 1830s, by the 1840s and 50s, by 1860, it had become a dominant institution in the North, not in the South. Again, Southerners, nah, we need public school system. It doesn't become much in the South until you get to the 20th century. And the time before they got there, Horace Mann had problems, and others that were teaching this public school system, is they kept using the McGuffey readers in the public school. You ever looked at a set of McGuffey readers? It is dominated by a biblical world and life view. It's just full of it. Well, by the 1880s, they began getting rid of the McGuffey readers. And by the time you get to the 20th century, they're gone. And you've got people like John Dewey saying in public education, now the purpose of the school system is not to teach learning. That's not what it's for. The purpose of the school is to produce the democratic child where we can all get along. And so get rid of God now. You've got to get him out of that picture. Okay, those are the three instruments. The progressive said, you use these instruments here, they'll guarantee you that progress will come and that it's inevitable. Okay, well, there are different types of progressives. As you're familiar with history, you know there are two different types of progressives. There's the revolutionary progressive. That's the guy who says we are to realize these progressive goals now, immediately. And don't pay attention to human life, human institutions. None of that has to be of any significance. Get rid of them, and if they resist the movement, eliminate them. Now, you remember the 20th century, we've had two of these type of progressives. The communist, who came to power in Russia in 1919, 1920, they were progressives. And the Nazis, who came to power in Germany in the late 20s, were progressive, and they were clear about it. What were their goals? We're going to create a new order. And anybody that's in the way, get rid of them. Just abolish them. The Germans said the people that are in the way are the herd. That's this lower class people who haven't evolved high enough. That's Jews and Gypsies and most of the Slavs, like Poles and Russians and Ukrainians, Bulgarians and Romanians. The Romanians, not so bad. They're kind of Germanic. Hungarians, well, we can get along with them, but the Czechs, not too well. So what do you do with those people? You turn them into working in the factories and turn them into slave labor, and if they get in the way, you get rid of them, kill them, eliminate them. If you're a communist and came to power, who's the enemy? Well, that's basically an economic problem, they said, and it's the difference between the have and the have-nots and ownership of private property. So you get rid of those people. And you get rid of them by force. And so in 1936 or so, the Russians, the government, the communists, removed all private property and among the kulaks, they called them, which were small landowners. And they went and took the property from them, and if you got in the way, they killed them. Somewhere between 3 to 6 million people were killed. And those who weren't killed, a lot of them starved to death. And it was an interesting story. They got rid of those people, and you know what happened in Russia almost immediately? Food shortages. They are the guys who are producing the food. Under a private enterprise, you know, they own their property, produce the stuff, you could sell it, get what you could for it, and that gave you an incentive to produce. Communists said that's wrong incentive. We ought to do this for the good of the people, and they don't do it for that, well, then kill them and get rid of them. So those are the kind of progressives that are around. Now, of course, they came to power in China. Estimates are 60 to 100 million Chinese were killed back there in the 1960s and 70s during that revolution. Now, the other progressive is the evolutionary progressive. That's the kind we're more familiar with in the West. The progressive goals are to be realized gradually over a period of time. It is to be done by the slow change of the institutions, customs, and public opinion through education and the progressive goals. So don't be brutal. Be easygoing about it, but gradually bring about the change, and we realize the progressive goals. Okay, well now, in order to be a progressive, it's necessary you follow the progressive creed. This is absolutely essential. Any progressive will tell you, this is what I believe, if he understands that. Now, I think a lot of people out there vote for these progressives. Don't do it because they understand the progressive creed. It has nothing to do with that. It's because they'll give them money. I don't have to work, and he'll give me money. He'll take care of me. And you have to be careful. We're involved in the same process ourselves. We'll think about that in a minute. But anyway, this is the creed. Number one, human nature is flexible, changeable, or highly plastic, so that man has a virtually unlimited capacity for progress. He is by nature basically good, or at the worst, he's neutral. And then they get down very dogmatic about that last sentence. He is emphatically not a sinner or depraved. There is no such thing as original sin. Now, you can understand why that last sentence upsets all progressives. If that's true, the whole progressive creed is humbug. It's baloney. It's not going to happen. Because there's something wrong with man that it can't fix. And he can't fix himself. And you know that about your own experience, don't you? You ever have any struggles with yourself? If you say, I don't ever have any struggles about right and wrong or doing what's wrong, I'm going to say, I don't believe you, Harold. You've got a problem. I've got a problem. We all have a problem. But this much says, well, the problem is not original sin. It's not depravity. It's something else. So we need to keep that in mind. Now, all progressives have to say man is not a sinner. Secondly, reason is man's essence. With it, he can comprehend the world and his own problems, and he can solve them. So it's just a matter of studying the problem, the difficulty, and through a rational process, we'll finally decide what these problems are. And if you find out what the problem is, you can work out a solution. You can solve it. Fix it. The principal obstacle to a good society are twofold. Number one, ignorance or inadequate education. Why is a man a criminal? Well, he must be ignorant. Doesn't make any sense. You going to go steal $20 and run the risk of going to jail for 20 years? Does that make sense? Of course it doesn't make any sense. So it must be that he's just acting in ignorance. Or he hadn't been adequately educated. Or it could be faulty social institutions. That could be anything. Be the family, school, the church, the Boy Scouts, whatever they are. Any social institutions out there has a tendency to be faulty. And if it is, it helps to create this problem that is an obstacle to a good society. Boy Scouts. They wouldn't hire homosexuals in positions of authority and what have you. Well, the progressive says, now, that's a faulty social institution. It's not being democratic. It comes up with these moral standards, and that word moral, they don't like that word, because moral standards leads to what? Diversity and separation. We've got to get rid of that. And now, increasingly going on in institutions, Amanda was calling us the other day about in Charlotte, North Carolina, in the public school system, they've been, the faculty head of it was called to a meeting before school started, and they were urged, now you need to be careful in your classrooms and in the halls and where else, talking about boys and girls. Those terms are divisive. And therefore, restrooms are going to have to be just virtually thrown open, because we must recognize there is basically no fundamental difference. Well, yeah, you, well, of course, they're, what it is bordering on insanity. It's absurd. But anyway, that's where that comes from. You see, we've got to get rid of these faulty social institutions. Now, in order to abolish one of the factors blocking progress toward the good society, there must be universal education. Everybody must be sent to school. No exception to the rule. Must be sent to school. The progressive view is, of course, by what they mean by school now is not private schools, and certainly not Christian schools. They want schools that are controlled by the progressive mentality, and everybody fundamentally is taught the same thing, because the object is to produce the democratic child, where everybody gets along. And if you let Christian schools come along or other private schools come along, they may have a different emphasis and a different thrust, and that's really not acceptable. So we must have universal education, and it must be fundamentally in the control of the progressive mentality. Okay, well, now, in order to get rid of these faulty social institutions, there must be political, economic, and social reforms that must take place. Absolutely essential. A little background about what's have to set this up, where this could be realized. 1861 to 65, they went to war, called the war, I call it the war of Northern aggression and Yankee imperialism. The history books won't say civil war. Now, if you look up a dictionary, civil war said that is a struggle between three or more factions for control of the same government. Now, if that's the case, then we didn't have a civil war, because the South said we're not interested in the same government, we're going to establish a government of our own. Lincoln and others realized, and you've got to call it the Civil War. Otherwise, it puts us, those people over there, Lee called them, in the position of being aggressors of oppressing people. So we're having a civil war. Southerners didn't think that, didn't call it that. And what was that war about? Well, that war was about the question, really, of what is the nature of this government in this country? Is this a federal republic, a federal union, or is it a consolidated democracy? When I started teaching at Texas County College, we had the American history course. There were two, the first half from the colonial period up through the war was by John D. Hicks. The textbook was called The Federal Union, and the book was gray. Now, old Hicks was a professor out at the University of California. He knew what he was doing, though. The second book from 1865 on was called The American Nation, and it was blue. You see what Hicks was saying in the textbooks, titles? We went from a federal republic to a consolidated democracy by that war. Well, now how can you guarantee that's going to take place? Well, you can't leave the Constitution like it was. So right after the war, there came the 13th Amendment, which eliminated slavery, And that amendment created no problems north or south. Southern states voted for it as rapidly as they did in the north. And then came the 14th and the 15th Amendments, 1867, 68. When they proposed the 14th Amendment, in that amendment, they turned all Americans into American citizens. You see, before the war, you were a citizen of the state. The federal government had virtually no authority over you, none, almost none whatsoever. And most people's contact with a sheriff or a police department or the county judge or the county sheriff. And it, president of who? I don't know who the president is and don't give a hoot because I have nothing to do with him. The governor, I don't know who the governor is. Doesn't have anything to do with the governor anyway. He doesn't have any authority over me, virtually none. It's the county that does. Well, now, 14th Amendment changed that. And so when they proposed the 14th Amendment to the states for a three-fourths approval, the South was back in the Union and had been restored, supposedly. And when they gave that amendment, proposal to amendments to the southern states, you know, in the Arkansas legislature, they approved the 13th Amendment, no problem. When the guy read the 14th, there was a loud outburst of laughter. Approved the 14th. Of course we're not going to approve the 14th Amendment. That's what the war was about. We don't want to be American citizens. This is a federal republic, not a consolidated democracy. Well, it was obvious the 14th Amendment wasn't going to pass. No southern state was going to vote for it. So how'd they get it passed? The Reconstruction Act of 1867 abolished all southern governments, put the South under military control of five military districts, with a major general control of each district, put the legislatures out of office, and then defranchised any Confederate soldiers or office holders, politically or military, where you couldn't vote and you couldn't hold office. And of course, they put in new governments in all those states, which were made up of what? Reconstructionists, and oftentimes blacks who were told how to vote. And they, you know, most of them didn't know what to do by it anyway. And a little Professor Baylor telling about it, he said his, when they came out with the Reconstruction Act and passed, they gave the enfranchise to the blacks. He said they showed up at the courthouse and they came for the franchise. And the guy said, well, here it is, you need to sign up. He said, no. I want the food. Man, the franchise said nothing. He said, I thought you're going to give us some food. No, I'm not interested in voting. I want some food. So, but anyway, they used them, put in Reconstruction governments, and they passed all the 14th Amendments. And they thought they had. After they passed it, New Jersey and Ohio said, you know, we've been thinking about that thing, and we are repealing our vote on the 14th Amendment. Presiding member of the Senate, senator said, you can't do that. That's against the Senate rules. So your vote originally was accepted. So the 14th Amendment got passed barely through that process, and that's the way they got the 15th Amendment. Now, once that had happened, then, of course, the federal system began to have increasing authority over individual citizens in the country. And then came the 16th Amendment. Now, what is the 16th Amendment? Passed in 1913. You all experience it every April 1st, right? It's the progressive income tax. See, the progressive view is, economically, we should not allow these distinctions between rich people and poor people, and that's not progressive. So what do we need to do? Well, we need to take the money from those who have it and give it to those who don't have it. So they got the amendment passed in 1913. Now, they got it passed basically because it virtually had nothing to do with anybody. Because the first progressive tax bill was in 1914, you had to pay it. You had to make $4,000 before you had to file. You know how many people made $4,000 a year in this country in 1913, 14? Almost nobody. Because that was a lot of money. I'll give you an example. You know, you could go to New York City in 1910 or 1913, with a $20 gold piece and bought the best suit in town. You know something? You still can with a $20 gold piece. It's amazing. But anyway, and then the amendment will say, if you made, I believe it was $500,000 or more, you owed 5%. And fill out this little card, and it's the side of a postcard. Fill it out and mail it in. That's it. Well, of course, the vast bulk of the public, you see, had the progressive income. I don't have anything to do with that because I don't make that kind of money. But just hang around. You see, the progressive understands you got to be careful of this stuff. Do it slowly and gradually, and so you can keep expanding it. And after a while, I got everybody in it. And we go long forms and all into it. Okay. Now, that's an economic reform. The 17th Amendment became law in 1914. What was the 17th Amendment? The 17th Amendment created the direct election of senators by the citizens of the state. You see, before 1914, senators were not elected. You didn't vote on the senator in your state. He didn't run for office. He was appointed by the state legislature under the founding constitution because the founder said the senators are to represent the state government, to keep the federal government from encroaching on the powers of the state. That's what they're there for. So they'll heed the views of the state legislature. Now the progressive said, until we get that political change, we can never realize all these reforms. Because the state legislatures are going to say, no, you're encroaching on the power of the state. That'll not pass the Senate. So, elect senators directly. And since they're going to be in power, and we can start gradually increasing this handout business, we'll sucker the public into voting for these guys who say, vote for me because I'm going to give you this. I'm going to give you that. I'm going to do the other. Absolutely necessary, said the progressive, for a political reform. Then there's the 18th Amendment. That's a social reform. The 18th Amendment was what?
Liquor.
Yeah, the liquor. It's a prohibition amendment. It had been a view in this country since the 1830s that whiskey is the fundamental problem that leads to poverty and criminal conduct and what have you. And so the temperance movement got started in the 1830s, 1820s and 30s and what have you. And continue to progress this until by the time you get to the 20th century, a little over half of the states were had already had prohibition amendments in the state legislatures. But now progressive view, that's not, no. You can't leave that up to the states. This has to be done nationally. So they got the 18th Amendment in 1918. And then the 19th Amendment, another social reform. What did the 19th Amendment do? That's right, it gave women the power to vote. Now, some states, they were already voting. That was up to the state legislature. Under the federal constitution, that's the way it was. When the founders established the constitution, it said very clearly, who defines who votes? The state legislatures, not the federal government. All it said about that was, whoever the state's permitted to vote are permitted to vote in a federal election. But no federal official ever gets involved in who gets to vote in what state. We don't. That's up to you. Well, 15th Amendment and 14th and 15th turned the vote over to all males. And then the 19th Amendment turned the vote over to all women. Absolutely essential in order to realize the progressive goals. Okay, well, and thus, you see, what you increasingly get here is a consolidated democracy, in which the state legislatures become virtually irrelevant. And governors become increasingly irrelevant because they have the ultimate authority is where? Not in Little Rock or in Austin, but in Washington. Now, the states can still give them a lot of trouble if it got the courage. Like Texas about that, this bathroom law, we're not going to do that. And that's the way to do it. Now, no, that's federal law. I don't care what's federal law. In this state, that ain't going to happen. And force that bunch up there to get mean. Make them get mean. Don't don't go along with that crowd because of this regressive mentality. Okay, well, now, the progressive goals also says in the progressive creed, there are no absolute values or eternal truths. Nobody or no one can say what is true or even whether there is such a thing as truth. Who's to say? I had a niece who went off to the University of Arkansas. This has been about 1986 or 7, 8. And family always got together on the 4th of July on the lake, what have you. And she'd been in the university, I believe this was her second year. And she came and was announcing though some major discovery. There is no such thing as truth. I said, Carl, have you lost your mind? Give me that pistol. Ain't any truth? Why shouldn't I just shoot you? Tell me why I shouldn't shoot you. That's an absurd position. Because there's no truth, there's no meaning, there's no purpose, and there's no life. And progressivism is silly. Why should I be a progressive if there's no truth? You guys, your very statement itself denies the whole system. Well, anyway, but they're very dogmatic about that now because, you see, if there are absolute values, then there's an absolute giver. And he troubles them. I guess he does. But what is his response to that? He that sits in the heavens, what's the second psalm say? He laughs. I will have them, he says, in derision. What such a fool notion. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament declares his handiwork. Day after day, it displays his truth. Night after night, it displays knowledge. There's no voice or language where its voice is not heard. And you're going to say there's no truth and I don't exist? Paul says in Romans 1, you remember? So they are without an excuse. Because they know God. Now they're going to say, no, I don't. There is no such thing. Paul says and the Bible says, you're trying to fool yourself, aren't you? There is a God. And you know it because you continuously are functioning in his universe and your conscience is accusing or excusing you. And where in the world did all that come from? Well, anyway. But that's a progressive mentality. And, of course, you adopt that mentality, then, of course, what's wrong with killing Jews or gypsies or Slavs or political deviants or babies in abortion? Why not kill them? Say that's wrong. Just that nobody knows anything or knows any kind of truth. Okay, well, I'm going to read something to you in a minute. What are some of the conclusions to be drawn from the progressive creed? And I think they've been drawn by the culture. Ideas do have consequences. I mean, what a man thinks in his heart, so is he. So he believes, so he acts. Number one, the individual is not responsible for his actions. His problems are the result of a lack of education or faulty social institutions. So, for example, let us get rid of the concept penitentiary. You know, that was a move that came along in the 1920s. Because what does the word penitentiary mean? It comes to the word penal. What does the word penal mean in Latin? Punishment. You shouldn't punish people. Because it's not his fault. So what should we call them? What do they call this place out here now? The Federal Correctional Institution. We're going to just imprison him and we'll correct him. usually they come out of there worse than they were when they went in, quite frequently. But anyway, that's the mentality of that. Man becomes a law unto himself, so he himself must play God or delegate his decision-making to somebody else. There's going to be an authority. And get God out of the picture, then who is it? Well, you become your own authority. Or if you don't have that kind of courage, you'll say, well, let them decide that. And that group in Washington or the legislature in Little Rock or someplace. But anyway, I don't have to do that myself. There must be no distinction between men. All must be level to the standard of the mass, always justifying this living as democracy. All men are equal, aren't they? Well, what's the Declaration of Independence says? That God created man equal. What they meant was equal before the law. They didn't mean equality. That was being debated one time in the Senate in 1831 or two, something like that. And old John Randolph of Virginia, Roanoke, got up and made the statement. He said, equality, I hate equality. Free men are not equal. And equal men are not free. You want me to vote for this piece of legislation? He said, not on your life. I'm not equal to you and you're not equal to me, except before the law. And quit trying to make people equal. We're not equal. Leave it alone. Well, the progressive said, well, you can't do that because if it's like that, well, then there are going to be some people who are going to be better off than other people. And anyway, we got to get rid of that. And then life has a tendency to lose meaning and direction under a progressive mentality. If he gets consistent and thinks about it, he winds up in a kind of a meaningless existence. I'll tell you a good example of that. Was old Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway was raised in Chicago, if I remember, in the home of a congregational family who were Calvinist. And he went off to university, rejected the Scriptures and rejected Calvinism, became a progressive, and then he got to thinking, what is this all about? And you read his books, they're full of depression and ultimate meaninglessness. You remember For Whom the Bell Tolls? The guy goes off to the Spanish War, Civil War, so-called, to fight on the side of the freeing the Spanish people and all that kind of stuff. What happened to the hero in the end? Yeah, he got killed. He got it in the end. Hemingway saying, that's what that was worth. Going off and join some cause. That's what it'll come to. And then the old man in the sea, you remember, he goes out, catch the fish, and he caught this big old huge fish. Brought the thing up to his boat and tied it on the side of the boat and was rowing it in as a trophy. And the sharks began attacking it. And so he beats off the shark with his oars and what have you, wears himself completely out, breaks the oars, finally he's not able to continue up. The shark's got all the fish, and when he gets to the beach, what has he got? A skeleton. What is Hemingway saying in that book? Go on out there and expend all that energy and effort. What will it get you in the long run? Nothing. You know, he's right. If you adopt this progressive philosophy. But if you want to read a book of depression, read Somerset Maugham's book called Human Bondage, of Human Bondage. You know, Philip's got a club foot, the hero of the story. And he spends his life, you know, struggling with that club foot and all its difficulties and what have you. Finally, winds up at the end of the book after all these problems, which he never can solve. And he's sitting out, they've gone to an art museum with his girl. They're sitting out and talking about the art museum and what did all those paintings mean. And there's all this modern art stuff. And you know what the conclusion was? What those paintings meant was the same thing life meant. Nothing. It was just meaningless. So Philip had a club foot, God didn't have anything to do with that, and he was just born that way, the meanings of existence. And that's not only him, but the whole of life itself. I think that's where progression leads to him. If you think about it, take God out of the picture, and you're headed for the abyss. Well, let me read you a statement here before we finish from Philip Johnson's book, Reason in the Balance, The Case Against Naturalism in Science, Law, and Education. If you haven't read that, it would be a good thing to buy it and read it. Not too expensive, and it's excellent. Published in 1995. He's a professor at the University of California, I believe, at Berkeley. And anyway, in the book, he's talking about progressivism and what it leads to in terms of morality. And then he talks about its economic views. We have to have all these economic reforms. And he goes to point out these economic reforms involve enormous outlays of government money, which they don't have. And the public doesn't have, because the people, if they tax the people, that's all they needed. Then the guy who's being taxed says, I'm not going to continue working doing all this. Let it go. You wind up like the communists did, with a failed system. There's a good book out there, by the way, on that called Socialism, A Pattern for Failure. And what the author does, he goes through 13 countries in the world that adopted socialist mentalities, and he progressively shows how in all 13 cases it led to failure. He said, of course it did. It doesn't work according to the violation of God's law. But anyway, let's read this statement, and you're going to realize it, I think, be aware of this too. About all this government outlay of money. The result of these government expenditures is that the government has increasingly to finance its expenditures with borrowed money and to conceal its real cost with even more elaborate financial gimmickry. Like the Federal Reserve System printing all this money. And then now we owe $19 trillion. A financial crisis is inevitable. By sometime not far into the 21st century, and he published this book in 1995, all the revenues available to the government will be consumed by entitlements and interest on the federal debt. To try to solve the budgetary crisis with economic policy measures is about as realistic as treating cancer with painkillers. The financial deficit is merely a reflection of an underlying moral deficit, which is incurable unless there is a moral renewal. And what he argues in this, that book is, you devote the Christian faith and biblical standard of right and wrong, you're going to wind up with a moral deficit, and this is what it'll get you. And are they going to solve that? He said, not in the slightest possibility. They hadn't got the courage. And let me ask you a question. Have you got the courage to vote for a guy who says, if you elect me to Congress now, we're going to put an end to this program, that program, this program, Federal Board of Education is going to be abolished, done away with totally. The federal government will not be involved in schools, period, and no money. And Social Security, that's going to have to be reduced, or the increase ages up to at least 70 before you can retire, and then a limit on how much you can draw. It's going to have to come. The guy says, well, I paid into it. I remember my dad's view about that. Dad retired at about 68, 70. He got a check for $800 in the mail on Social Security. He said, what are they doing? Well, that's your Social Security payment. He said, are they out of their minds? I didn't put in about $150 a month, and they want to pay me $800? Are they crazy? He said, it doesn't make any sense. Exactly what he said here. Of course it doesn't make sense. Well, progressivism, that's what it is, where it got us, and it's a direct result of abandonment of the Christian faith. And until the Christian faith is restored to this country in a great revival, there's no reason for us to anticipate it'll get any better, because the public does not have the courage to vote those kind of guys in office. Which is why Lord Macaulay, remember, said, that's why you don't let everybody vote. He said, oh, no. Unless a man pays taxes and owns property, you don't let him vote. If you do, that majority will vote to take the money of those who are producing and give it to themselves, and then you're headed for an inevitable crisis, which is, you know, he's exactly right. Well, any question now? It's time to quit. Yes, right, right.
Do you think that, in a sense, he got the idea that everything is meaningless without God?
Oh, yes.
Is that what he was saying?
I think that's what that book's about. Take God out of the picture, and what have you got? Meaningless existence. Until you get down to chapter, what is it, chapter 12? Remember now thy creator in the days of thy youth. And if you do that, it works itself out. Well, anyway, hopefully this has been meaningful and help you to understand what's going on and why it makes a difference what the people believe. It makes a world of difference. Okay, let's stand, please, and we'll be dismissed.